I've enjoyed playing here. It's been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. This is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people's been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
Welcome back to another episode of Australian Golf Passport. Scott Warren here, and as always, riding shotgun is Matty Mollica. Hey, Matty.
Hi, Scott. Great to chew the fat with you again. Lots of different things to cover in a rapid-fire session before we move on to the main fare of Mike DeVries for this episode.
Yes, Mike was an absolute superstar. Love chatting to him. One of the best guys in the industry and very generous to give us some of his time.
Yeah, real treat to talk with him. I'm not sure that he's going to come back all that often. He's made a lot of trips down here in the last couple of years and spent a lot of time here, but he's getting to that stage of the project where it's nearing completion and his hand in that is wrapping up. And it's up to Tui and the others to get the grass to grow and Matt Goggin to come back and cut the ribbon at some stage. So, yeah, good to talk to Mike while he was here and get a bit of an insight into what he's been doing down on one of the best sites for a golf course in this country.
Yeah. Mate, it's been a big week in Melbourne for not playing golf, but for buying and selling golf.
Yeah. News in the Australian Financial Review today that the Kingswood site has been sold by Australian Super. Satterley bought the Kingswood Golf Course site for a reported $220 million. So that is a huge residential land deal, probably the biggest in this country to date for the calendar year and one of the biggest that Satterley's ever been involved with. So significant increase in ticket price from what Australian Super paid for that site going back, the better part of a decade now. Not sure how some of the people at Peninsula Kingswood will be feeling at the moment, probably wishing that Satterley could just sling them a couple of million, try and make up for that third payment that never materialised that should have. But
yeah,
it seems like that site is finally going to be covered by houses, which people thought would have been the case years ago. And on that front, in terms of golf buying and golf selling, the asking price for the Cranbourne Golf Club site has widely been reported in local media in the last week as being in the order of $150 million. I've got a great overhead view of that site and local Melbourne golfers, regular Melbourne golfers through the Sand Belt and Mornington Peninsula sort of have a pretty good feel for where Cranbourne is, how far it is from the CBD, and it's really an island of green space in a rapidly filling area that is just covered by residential properties. So the owners of that site will probably realise that asking price, and there'll be more houses in a seemingly semi-densely populated stretch a long, long way from the CBD. So
Now Kingswood obviously disappearing from the eastern end of the Sand Belt, and there's a lot of Sand Belt golf still there for golfers around that Cranbourne area. As a Sydney sider who doesn't know it tremendously well, it's kind of thinner pickings down there, right? This actually takes away a reasonable amount of the supply.
Yeah, I suppose those golfers will probably start to look towards Amstel and Settlers Run.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be two of the closer options for them. Some will probably just get in their cars and either join the National if they could, play on the peninsula somewhere if they could, join Peninsula Kingswood if they could. Yeah, there's a couple of different options for them. Not all of them are going to go to Huntingdale under that initial agreement that was signed by Cranbourne and Huntingdale when they first floated the idea of selling the property. So some will have gone across.
Amstel's ran Furley, is that right?
Yeah. So
they used to have 36 and now they've only got 18?
Yeah, so they had an Amstel course for a long, long time. And then Clates did Ranfurly for them. And then they let Amstel go. And so the whole club just now plays across Ranfurly.
So that whole little corner of Melbourne is hemorrhaging golf a little bit then. Between the Amstel course and now Cranbourne. I'm saying that wrong, aren't I?
Oh, you're right. Cranbourne.
I feel like an American trying to say Melbourne.
Melbourne, the UN.
Melbourne. Yeah, well, I'm getting it wrong, but apologies.
Well, we had spoken prior to hitting the record button tonight about what news we had and what a big week it's been. And you're right in that area has lost at least 36 holes in recent memory.
Yeah.
But they've been able to retain 9 holes of public golf at Oakley.
Yes.
Sandy Jamieson's crusade to maintain Oakley Golf Course as a public facility and not a parkland has been victorious. So congratulations to Sandy and all of the people that frequent that site and all of the people who graduated through that one club approach to playing the game will no doubt be breathing a sigh of relief, and they'll be very happy to continue to enjoy that facility for a long time to come. So good news story there on that
front. Yeah. Really good outcome when that hasn't been the result at pretty much every other little golf course under threat. Although I note up in Sydney where Moore Park's getting cut in half, Beverley Park was seemingly under threat, but I have it on some authority that they've been told by the council that they have at least 10, probably 20-year period where they needn't worry about losing that. So, keep the can down the road a little bit, but good news for now at Beverley.
We should do a little business of our own prior to getting to Mike DeVries. You want to kick things off with an ad read for Matt and Angus and Grace Go Golfing?
I do, because I've been spruiking and we've been spruiking for months now that obviously Angus and Grace Go Golfing, brainchild of Matt Burns, he wanted golf gear that looked good on and off the course. He didn't like, he couldn't stop for a beer in Paddington on the way home or on the Lower North Shore, you know, walk into a pub and have people stare at him wearing his sport leisure, shiny golf shirt and looking very, you know, basically, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and along came Angus and Grace Go Golfing. And he's always stressed it's as much about wearing that stuff off the golf course as it is wearing it on the golf course. And I found a great new off the golf course use for Angus and Grace Go Golfing last Sunday night when I went along with my wife and two daughters to Taylor Swift's Eras Tour. And everyone kept saying, oh, week, aren't you a good dad going with your girls? I would have gone with or without the girls. I'm very passionately a Swiftie. And of course, one of the big things with the Eras Tour is going in dressed up as a Taylor Swift era or a character. And those who are Swifties, big fans of the album Lover, will know the song The Man. And I went as The Man. You might know from the film clip, the Taylor dressed up as a male tennis player in all white. So the white three-button polo went on along with some white shorts and tennis shoes and a headband on my bald dome. And I was The Man. So, and I felt like The Man in Angus and Grace, Matty.
You looked the part too.
Yeah, it was it was super good fun. And I was very, very comfortable in the, you know, 28, 29 degree evening temperatures in the Angus and Grace. So very pleased to find yet another off the golf course wear for Angus and Grace. So 3-button pocket polo. I know he's just re-upped some of the colours that have been selling quickly. Still $110. That's still really great value. It's gonna beat the pants off any of the, you know, the stuff you find in your local pro shop that's 170, 180 and just not, you know, a pinch of shit on what Matt's producing. So angusandgracegogolfing.com, Angus and Grace Go Golfing on Instagram, and Angus and Grace Go Golfing in William Street at Paddington in Sydney.
Still haven't been up to Sydney for the longest time. I cannot wait to get back up there because I'm stop number one is going to be Matt's store.
Yeah. Oh, you will flip when you get there.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah. I'm going to save up before I get there too.
Well, and the back room is full of like your weakness. You know, different men have different weaknesses, whether it's like gambling or whether it's, you know, grog or, you know, your golf one is bad enough just in terms of generally. When you walk into the back room to try on a shirt and you see all the persimmons and all the Japanese wedges and all the old Scotty Cameron, Terillian putters and 1970s answer putters, you're going to, you'll be done.
Yeah.
You'll be catching the bus down just like the character in, you know, To Her Door back to Melbourne, because you'll have sold your car. You won't be able to afford an airfare. Yeah, you're gonna fall hard.
Look forward to that. Now you have been on a very, very interesting trip, and you put some pictures up on the day and the day after. You've been to Broken Hill.
Yeah. Mate, somewhere I didn't think I would ever go, to be honest, and at least not till we're grey nomading, maybe. But had some cause to head out there for work, and it needed to be an overnight thing, just by virtue of what needed to be done and the times that the flights go in and out of Sydney. So yeah, was in Broken Hill for about 36 hours. Really, really cool town. I really enjoyed it. It takes some getting to, and I think that's probably part of why it is the way it is and it's so charming. But I also managed to sneak out to see the two golf courses that they have on offer. So for those who aren't familiar, we're about 13 hours drive west of Sydney. We're about 6 hours drive northeast of Adelaide, about 3 hours, 3.5 hours, I think, north of Mildura in the Riverina there. So yeah, it was very remote. It felt very remote. Two golf courses, as I mentioned. The first one I went and checked out just for a quick look before a meeting was South Broken Hill Golf Club, which is 18 holes. Sorry, I'm wrongly in an Instagram stories said it was a nine hole that you play twice. 18 holes. It's completely on red dirt. Greens are red dirt, bit of sand. There's really not a skerrick of grass on the place. Really just goes to show that, you know, I said on the Insta story, the spirit of golf is undefeated. You know, you take someone who's obsessed with the game, put them anywhere on the face of the planet, and they will find a way to play golf. And South Broken Hill Golf Club was definitely that. Had a quick little walk around there, covered in dust. I think in a cooler time of the year than February, it would be a lark to get around it and have a hit. There's some dry washes and some creek beds and whatnot that create a bit of interest, but very rudimentary golf. Sand greens, very small sand greens. Just really cool to see it and just see that people who love the game are finding a way to build golf and play golf. And the sign in the car park proudly said they had 50 golfing members who are also the people who look after the joint. So, yeah, it was really cool. But then about a 10-minute drive north of there is Broken Hill Golf Club. And Broken Hill Golf Club, full grass golf course, grass greens, some really good bunkering. Like, this is not a rudimentary golf course. This is a really good, solid golf course. So snuck out there. Set an early alarm because I had a feeling this was going to be unlike anything I'd played before. And it was just super cool, mate. It's surrounded by desert, surrounded by big red dirt hills. And the golf was actually sneaky good. I was expecting that it would be worth going out and seeing just because you're in the middle of the desert and, you know, there's a golf course there. Never played desert golf anywhere. Haven't played out at Alice Springs. Haven't played at Kalgoorlie. Haven't played desert golf in America. So it was something I wanted to do just to check that out. But 4 or 5 legitimately very, very good golf holes, just solid golf the whole way around, interacts really nicely with the desert. Like, it's there in front of you on probably 4 or 5 holes around the perimeter. Really good fun. I loved it. And it's always a mission of mine if I have to travel for work, if it's somewhere I don't know, just to go and even just eyeball the golf and see what it's like. But I was really stoked that I was able to play Broken Hill.
The pictures looked fantastic, and it probably would have exceeded your expectations in lots of different ways. Like, there was one particular green that was sort of benched into the hill very nicely with some really cool greenside bunkering that looked like it was quite well constructed.
Yeah, well, that was the thing that, for me, it was not just, you know, the features, but it was, as you call out there, there was probably 3 or 4 holes that had some really clever bunker shapes. On the ninth hole, which there's a picture of on our Instagram, there's some really nice kind of scalloped land movement that fed into a nice You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me a little bit of the bunkering. This is a big stretch, but the bunkering short right of 18 East Green at Royal Melbourne. It's just really nice and flowy in shape, and it shows off a bit of the land movement. There's no Dunks Island there, but just really nice. And then out on the third, which is one of the par fives, this cool, not quite centerline, but a bunker in the lap area in the fairway that has a nice, a nice shape to it. It's clear that someone who cares and sort of knows a little bit about what they're doing has put some time into building the golf there. You notice that it's not just, a circular little thing here and there. If you go to Broken Hill, I think I said on there, don't go to Broken Hill just to play golf here. But if you go to Broken Hill, if you go all that way, you absolutely, if you love golf, you've got to get out and play there.
Yeah.
And if you don't take your clubs, you're in for another little treat because they don't have hire sets as such. I rang up to check, can I hire clubs? Because my wife always raises an eyebrow at me when I go on a work trip and I pack my golf clubs. So I rang them up and said, oh, well, do you have hire sets? Yeah, we do. Absolutely. Cool. So I turn up and it's not that they have hire sets so much as they have a storeroom off the kind of all-in-one pro shop and bar. They have a little storeroom, Maddie, that's got five or six bags, and there's just random golf clubs in them. One of the bags had about 20 clubs in it. One of the bags had two clubs in it. And the woman just said to me, oh, just pull a set together. It just depends what you like. And it was a true, just absolute mixed bag of what there was. I spent probably about 15 minutes trying to pull together what's this set going to be that I'm going to go with. I ended up with a Prontek, which I don't know what that is. That was a three wood. That was the only wood they or three wood they had. It had a soft reg shaft, so I had to just swing nice and easy all day on that. There's a Black Scott, which I think is probably a rip-off of the old Tomiyama Silver Scott. Black Scott seven wood, marked as a five wood. I had an old Bruce Devlin Slazenger eight iron, a Wilson Fat Shaft six seven iron. There was just very randomly, like about a 6-year-old, quite modern Callaway 6-iron in there. I gather these are probably just clubs people have forgotten and left at the course and they've been handed in and just, mate, it was incredible. You remember the old when Callaway was getting big in the 90s? There was like this brand, I don't know, I was a kid then, so I was fixating, but there was this brand called Force 10. And it
Yes.
basically was just like really cheap and nasty, obvious rip-offs of Callaway. So I had a Force 10 Sam wedge. Mate, it was super. A couple of the clubs I couldn't hit because honestly, the grips were so shiny, I just couldn't keep hold of them. And proving what a stupid game golf is, I've been not playing great golf lately, and I've been fixating on gear because I was convinced that was the solution. Been spending more money than probably is smart on new driver shafts, and it's going to fix everything, Maddie. And then I turn up, I get this gear, and I've got no range finder, and they've got no distance markers. And I go out and I'm playing off five, and I have 38 points. So go figure. I don't know. Golf's a stupid game, and that is proof. I was probably using about four clubs, to be honest, because there was a few that just weren't real good to use.
Imagine if you'd had those clubs at the New South Wales Cup. You'd have been
I
top 10, mate.
would love to turn up to a big Vardon event with this bag of clubs and just see the looks that you get from people. Yeah, mate, honestly, though, it just shows, doesn't it, that I don't know, that stuff helps. It must help. But here I was. Yeah. So highly recommend Broken Hill. Highly recommend playing golf there. It's a cool town. It's kind of, the mining is falling away. The mines are downsizing, and as mining is in a lot of towns, but it's become a bit of a tourist hotspot, a big strong arts scene there now. So it's a town that kind of felt like it was in between a couple of release patterns, but it was still a mining town, but it's also an art town. Main street, mate, not too many for let signs. It's one of the depressing things about visiting regional Australia these days is there's a lot of main streets full of empty shops, but I didn't really see that in Broken Hill. the pubs were well attended, even on a Tuesday night. So yeah, it was good fun.
Excellent.
That's so yeah, good. There's pics of both courses up on our Insta if anyone wants to have a quick look. And yeah, jump, like, Google Broken Hill Golf Club and just look at the aerial. I mean, it's sitting there right in the middle of nothingness. It's really cool.
One little thing to do before we get to Mike DeVries. We're going to do a quick ad read for Burnley Brewing. And I want to draw people's attention to two little things that the guys at Burnley are doing at the moment. They now have an alcohol-free lager, which is a European-style non-alcoholic brew influenced from the Hell's Lager that they've done that many of you will be familiar with. All the flavour minus the booze, crisp, refreshing, full body, zero alcohol. So those of you who are consistent designated drivers or slaves to the 2024 goals, whether it be fitness, body weight, anything else, worth keeping that in mind. The other little project that I just want to keep an eye on that Burnley's doing at the moment, they haven't shown us what it's going into, but they have talked about this Eco Brew project that they're doing at the moment. And amongst all of the different socials that they've released on this is one huge boil pot of 35 kilos of lemon peel and 10 kilos of juniper berries. So I don't know what they're going to do with those, but my interest is piqued, and I look forward to tasting it when it's in a can. I don't think it's going to be like the seltzers. I think it's going to be in some sort of botanical style eco beer that they're going to brew, but I could be dead wrong, but we'll see. So Burnley Brewing, those of you who love your beers, and let's be honest, most of us do, keep your eye on Burnley Brewing. If you want to follow along with what they're doing, go and check them out on Instagram. Go and see them in Bridge Road, Richmond. They're getting more and more people to their Trivia Tuesdays as the days get a tiny bit shorter and daylight saving nears conclusion. So spend your Tuesday nights there if you're looking for something to do.
I don't think I've ever had a juniper. Do you know what juniper tastes like?
I reckon I've had it as a part of a dish with kangaroo.
Okay.
Juniper berry is used in gin, distilling, I should say.
Here we go. The taste of the juniper berry is fresh with a fruity citrus flavor and an aromatic piney spiciness. Sounds good. Well, and you mentioned the seltzers, Matty. I am currently working my way through a blood orange and ginger one. So a little care package came from Burnley while I was in Broken Hill. It was delightful to get home to it. And a very good person in my household had put a bunch of it in the fridge for me. So I was able to jump into one of these fresh off the flight home from Broken Hill via Dubbo, and it's amazing. I've had really high hopes for the seltzers, and I've been smashing through some of the blood orange and ginger. I've had some of the Kakadu plum. There's a finger lime and lemon myrtle in there that's calling my name eventually. So yeah, I was really keen to try these out in the hot summer months, and they came and they didn't disappoint.
I had someone put some of them in the fridge as soon as they arrived at my place as well, but she's slowly but surely been helping herself to them. So I've had one or two and they are very good. I fear that I won't get my hands on many more of them. But anyway.
She might have to do a few episodes of the pod with me just to earn her keep as a, you know, this is our salary she's drinking.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, very good.
All right. Speaking of salary, let's get into the reason why we're here. We spoke with Mike DeVries a few days ago, and I erroneously promised on Instagram that it would be out over the weekend. And
you do that every time. I love it.
I'll put my hand up and say that's 100% on me. Italian family source day. Things got a bit crazy, and yeah, the weekend disappeared before we knew it. But we've got stacks of passata, and that's not a bad thing.
Beautiful.
So Mike talks with us about 7 Mile Beach. He talks with us a little bit about his own body of work and a lot on construction, which I was really interested to listen to. So yeah, let's get into that.
And for those of you who are wondering, when is 7 Mile Beach going to open? He gets to that as well.
Critical. You know, that's the thing I always talk to people about. It's like when you fly over a city, what green space do you see? Golf courses, cemeteries, and parks. Not a very big percentage. I mean, sure, you see street trees, but street trees last for 15 years and then they replant another one, the same species, probably a Bradford pear in America. You know, and it goes and then it dies. they replace another 15 years. So, it, I mean, it's kind of, you know, that's another one of the things is that golf provides this environment for wildlife and, you know, other habitat, things like that too, which is really, really important. And people lose sight of that.
Hmm. I think the game's also not especially good at selling that message that the biodiversity, flora and fauna biodiversity benefits of a golf course, they benefit people who don't ever step foot on that golf course. And the environmental benefits and the, you know, the heat island effects that it reduces and all these sorts of things, clean air, everyone benefits from that around the golf course, even if they never step foot. But we're just not. I think golf kind of closed ranks as a game, and partially I think because there's this siege mentality, particularly in Australia, around urban golf. I think golf's just kind of pulled its head down, and I think maybe we need to do a better job of being salespeople for the benefits of golf courses and not, you know, just shutting up shop.
Right. You know, this sort of elitist thing about golf too is that these are golf courses that are public golf courses. Anybody can go play, anybody can go have a sandwich there or whatever. So, you know, you can enjoy that environment too. And I think that it is critical. I mean, at Seven Mile Beach, you know, these beautiful dunes right on the ocean were covered in basically a noxious weed, radiata pines. And we got rid of those. And now you can see the dunes and you can see the ocean and the shorebirds are back. And there's, you know, there's wildlife, you know, and things that wasn't there. It was devoid of that. So it's it really is a phenomenal thing. And, you know, this is going to be public golf. So people can come and play, and it's going to be world-class golf and a reasonable fee. It's not going to be like Pebble Beach at $650 or whatever crazy number they're at. So, yeah, I think it's, I think, you know, yeah, golf needs to do a better job of explaining the good things about golf. Mm. Absolutely.
Talking about Seven Mile Beach, Mike, do you remember your initial impressions when you first set foot on that site and when that first visit was?
First visit was early 2020. So Matt was, he lives in the States. And so he was coming over and Clayton called me and said, you know, Matt's, you know, he's nearing the end of his development application, sort of time period to have substantial commencement, et cetera. And he was coming over in February of 2020. And so Clayton's like, hey, you know, can you come over? I'm like, yeah, that'd be great. Because I'd never been on site. Clayton had been involved, you know, with whatever iterations that Matt had had over the years since they've known each other for a long, long time. And so I came over and I said, you know, I don't want to know about any or, you know, I want to just have like a fresh look at it and then be able to give, you know, Clayton's my, and Matt, give them my sort of, you know, well, this is what I see and, you know, what are we trying to do, et cetera. And so it was like having a non-biased, because there were times when we were like on the site and it's covered in these pine trees here and there. And there's some places that are a little bit open and some places, most of the places weren't. And so you could get some views maybe in some areas of, you know, maybe 100 yards or something, but it was hard to get anything a little bit longer than that. And they're like, oh, remember this place? Yeah, this was a great drive here and stuff. And I'm just like, don't talk to me. So, so I came over, Matt was over for a couple of weeks. So I came over and I left on March 14th and 4 days later, you know, the world exploded with COVID. And we were kind of like, when I left, it was sort of like, oh yeah, you know, see in a few months when this blows over. We didn't really have any idea what it was going to be. And, but it, you know, it was spectacular. There was really, really cool, neat stuff. And, you know, we had a topo map, but it always helps when you're, you know, you're just walking stuff and you're seeing it live and in person and things like that. And there were areas that were super thick and you really couldn't see very far at all. And so, you didn't really, you could just tell the scale of some of the stuff was really crazy. And there were other places where trees had been cut down from basically a chainsaw cutting class, where they went out there and they just used that for a general, they just dropped trees and then they left them there. And so it made hiking around in some spots really difficult. But you could also just tell, that there was a lot of variety and really, really interesting stuff, and how you could, trying to figure that out and getting a sense of how things would go together. And then in that 2 weeks, we really sort of decided on the routing. And, of course, when the trees came down, then, we made adjustments. And Clay saw that before I did, because I couldn't get back over. And the routing's basically in place, but we shifted the fourth hole up on, to stay on the ridge. And that made the fourth, instead of a par three, it made it a par four, played back down to the ocean. And that allowed just some shifting, little things like that. And once you get those things, and that happens throughout the process too. It's not necessarily, you don't just go, oh yeah, bing, and that's going to move. Because then as things kind of evolve, you're shifting stuff. And whether that's shifting something 10 feet or 50 feet, those are all like shifts to just make things better. To get to the pinnacle on the design, really to think about kind of how can we make it better? How can we just extract another 3 percentage points and move up the chain, And that's kind of, that's the beauty of being in the field. And that's the beauty of like having Clay's come every other week and, being able to go over stuff and then having a fresh perspective on this or that, to provide feedback. So that's been really great for us, the two of us, I think, to do that and to, to really make a better golf course for players and for Matt, and to make sure that all the things that he's looking at, what he wants to do and how that can be functional, etc.
Is he about as close as it gets to the ideal client in terms of the knowledge and the passion and the energy that he brings to a project like this?
I'd say he's right up there. I mean, I've had very good clients, for the majority of my projects over the 35, 40 years. But I'd say he's fantastic because he's extremely knowledgeable, super smart guy, and he's very intellectual about things, but he's not demanding of, hey, I want to have a signature. I want to have like my bunker or this thing, or, he's letting us evolve and he's discussing this with us in the field and stuff too. So when, something's roughed in and he sees that, and he and Clayton and I are out there and we're looking at things, then, we have some discussion about it. Maybe I've built something and I'm like, well, this is what we tried to do and it doesn't feel quite right. And, we just have a conversation and all of that sort of gets absorbed. And in some cases, I'll take that information and just sort of, kind of let that percolate while I sort of adjust and change things. Because, you can literally erase something and rebuild it and do that with the sand. So that's a really nice factor. That's been a really helpful thing as far as that. So Matt's been an integral part of that. Not as much as Clayton and me, just because we're more tuned into, and he, Matt's worrying about a lot of other stuff, but we're also, we're thinking about it all the time. And he recognizes that. He's like, I'm not a designer. He's, and he thinks about golf, from his super high level, great player, stalwart for 15 years on the PGA Tour and top 50 player in the world and all that. And, but he also recognizes that not everybody plays at his level. And so how can it be fun and maintainable, and how can it keep people engaged and interested and things like that? So he's fantastic. Really, really incredible, I think.
Yeah, I've often thought of him throughout this process. We've heard once or twice with him discussing the project and Mike discussing the project and yourself during that chat with Shane Darby on his Firm and Fast Golf podcast that aired last month, that he really is at times adopting a hands-off approach, and he feels eminently comfortable with you guys working on the site, and he's leaving you to it. And he's not really craving a lot of detail and a plan from which you don't deviate. He doesn't have a black and white, beautiful route plan hanging there that he can look at. I suppose he's going to get a good first look at it not too long before the rest of us get a good first look at it when it's all grassed and ready for play.
Yeah. No, I think that's very accurate. He, certainly, you can run into clients who are like, oh, we're going to have some, flyby videos and blah, 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 and, 3D this or that. And, he's like, he understands that there's this evolution, and we're constantly refining that to get to the top of the pyramid. And, this has been a small crew, Tasmania, Hobart's not a small city. I mean, it's 250,000 people, but Tassie's small, sort of in the relative scheme of things. So not everything's right around the corner. A lot of times it has to come in from the mainland, and that's not the most efficient thing sometimes. just getting the bulldozer, the type of bulldozer that I wanted. I mean, they don't have small shaping bulldozers down here. They're like, in America, I can go to like just about any small town in America. I can get a bulldozer for, in 3 days or something. It's like, oh, that'll work. That'll be great. There's just more of it there, whether that's good or bad. But those types of things are, which is fine, but it also, the advantage of that is it gives us time to be able to sit back and look at stuff and really absorb what it is or what we like or we're tentative about, things like that. And how do we make it better? And that's the beauty. Clates has got, he remembers every tournament, every golf hole, every swing. He's always out there just without a club in his hand, just making golf swings. Just like everyone, the first time they meet him, like, is he swinging a club? Like, yeah. He's just pure to 3-iron or whatever, it's great.
If my golf swing was as perfect as Mike's, I think I would just, stand in the street demonstrating that golf swing as well, even if there was no purpose to.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned how small Tasmania is, and, I guess you can't stress enough how far it is, literally and figuratively from Traverse City in Michigan. Could you have ever imagined that, maybe not the two most impactful projects that you'll carry out in your career, but two of the candidates, would be on this tiny little, collection of islands at the other end of the world?
No, I mean, when Cape Wickham came about, that was a dream, and it was, this great site and super diverse, and the kids, so at that time, my daughter was in college and my son was 14, and they found some website that you put in where you live and it tells you the opposite side of the world. Because we have this thing in America, you're digging a hole to China, Well, China's in the Northern Hemisphere, so it doesn't really make much sense unless you're digging at an angle. And lo and behold, from Traverse City, Michigan, it's about 800 miles west of Tasmania. It's actually in the ocean is basically the opposite part. So we are literally pretty much halfway around the world, which is kind of nuts. But yeah, that was amazing and, fantastic project and really, we love King Island. It's just a really fantastic place. People are awesome. say it's amazing. You know, the golf course turned out really, really well. And so the opportunity to come back, you know, was really, you know, was, you know, dream two, I guess. Cause we love Tasmania. It's fantastic. And Hobart's a great town, you know, and it's a much bigger, you know, King Island's a very small environment, which is fantastic. Not necessarily a bad thing about that. But Hobart has, you know, all of Australia is not accessible by Americans. And I keep telling them that like, just go, it's worth it.
Yeah.
And, I think, but, you know, Hobart's 250,000 people. So there's a lot of, you know, food and culture, museums, and, you know, there's great hikes and, you know, amazing things to see down here. And it's nice to come to your summer and have long days, you know, which is really nice. It's not, you know, Michigan has, you know, we obviously have harder winters and things like that. But we're really near, you know, basically right on Lake Michigan. So it's big water, but it's fresh water. And so we're sort of used to that moderation too. We're used to that where it's a little cooler in the summer where we're at, and it's a little warmer in the winter than like inland 20 miles or something. But, you know, we still get a lot of nice snow and great, you know, four seasons and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's cool.
I saw from an interview that you did with Golf Club Atlas in 2002, you were asked, what's the golf course that you haven't seen that you most want to anywhere in the world? And your answer was Royal Melbourne. I assume that probably didn't happen until you started working on Cape Wickham. Do you recall the first visit you made to Royal Melbourne and your impression of RM versus maybe what you'd built up in your head?
It was well before that, actually. So I was there in 2007, I think.
Oh, okay.
So I was over, I went to Titirangi, for the Mackenzie Society meeting. And my friend David Edel, who was the guy who found the lost Mackenzie, El Boquerón, plan down in Argentina. And so we were presenting that to the committee, and we're like, hey, we got to go to Australia. We're almost there. And, you know, so we spent a couple of weeks doing that too. And, so that was really amazing. And so the first time it was on the property at Royal Melbourne, Dr. John, the historian, John Green. Yes. Sorry. How can I forget that? So I had, somehow gotten connected with John, and he was in the midst of, he hadn't written a book yet, you know, on the history of the courses, but he had all of this great information and stuff. And so basically David and I, we were just like soaking up like everything he was talking about. It was awesome. And, you know, we played the West course and walked the East course in the same day. And he's trudging along with us the whole deal, you know, and he's at that point, he wasn't quite 80, but, you know, he was at least mid 70s, maybe a little bit older. And, he was there with us every step of the way. And, it was just, you know, what a fantastic guy he was. And, It was really steeped in sort of learning all about the various iterations and what how things evolved at the golf course, which is cool. That's stuff that I didn't know about that stuff before. So that was really fascinating for me. And then just to see, you know, the greens and the contours and, you know, 4, 5, 6, and, you know, how these things worked around the hill and that sort of stuff was really just amazing. So it there's a lot of buildup there. And when you go to someplace with these high expectations, it's rare that they're met or exceeded. And I would say Royal Melbourne was, you know, definitely one of those where, you know, it definitely met the expectation and probably surpassed it. Well, I mean, everyone talks about 10th hole is great, but how good is the 9th hole? And people don't talk about it. I mean, there's a bunch of holes here we could dissect, but I mean, and I haven't spent enough time there. You know, the thing that's great about those great golf courses is like every time you're there, you see more and you learn more. And, you know, that's Crystal Downs for me, you know, growing up there and working there, playing there and spending thousands of days there. And I still see little bits and pieces and different things every time I'm on the property.
Considering the number of visits you've made, the number of rounds you played, the work you did there, that there's still things that pop up during a visit. That is really striking. Yeah.
Well, I didn't caddy there. I worked in the bag room. We didn't have caddies when I was there.
Ah,
remember, okay. I'm old. My son caddied though. He was caddying there. But you know, working. I mean, we're on the golf course every day and probably playing after work. It was really different 45 years ago. And there'd be like one group out in the back nine and we'd lock the shop. We'd lock the door. They'd just leave their clubs on their cart and we'd go play. And then we'd come back, put the clubs away and pick the range and, you know, and then when I was working on the grounds crew, that's why I got into designing golf courses. I was on the golf course every day and I was mowing greens or cutting cups and raking bunkers. And, you know, I was seeing these things and feeling these things as you were doing them. And those nuances are things that, you know, GPS guidance can't do. It just is not the same thing. I have to literally be on the sand pro and feel it when I'm floating a green, you know, I don't know how to sort of explain that, but it's an inherent thing. And then, you know, we still measure and do stuff, but there's something about that, about, you know, feeling how that flows together and how things turn and stuff like that. And, you know, you just got to shave a little bit here, a little bit there. That's a different thing. Well, I'll put it this way. So one of the guys that's working on the crew down here at 7 Mile, Kelly Ottaway, he was a professor of music and he's a jazz pianist and vibraphonist and stuff like that. And he wants to get in, you know, he's an older guy. He's not 25. And he taught music here at UTAS for a bunch of years and stuff. And, he just wants to get into golf. He loves golf and he wanted to do something different, but he still plays gigs and all this. And that's when I saw the text. It was like, I went to hear him play because there's a jazz festival this weekend. And, you know, he's up there. And when you watch him play and he's just, his eyes are closed and he's listening to the other guys play and, you know, they riff off of each other and do all this stuff. And I have no musical talent. I really appreciate it, but I can't do that. But he was asking me a question the other day, you know, like, what are you doing when you're on the dozer? How do you do that? I said, well, it's kind of like watching you play jazz and how you are reacting to what the other guys are doing, this and that. And you just feel that because you have that capacity and that ability to do that. So that's the only way that I could sort of answer his question and sort of make it relatable to him. And maybe that makes sense to some people. I guess it's a little different way to look at it, but it's the same type of inherent, you know, thing that you can sense and react to versus just having it be a formula.
I wonder if that's what gives you the courage or the license to build the kinds of things that you build. Because, you know, Kingsley, grey walls, you know, pretty bold, you know, aggressive courses in terms of the landforms they encounter and the way they take them on and the scale and size, and a lot of Klaitz's repertoire has similar calling cards. You know, there's some stuff at Bonnie Doon, the lakes, that is, it's a lot. And a lot of people would have said, you know, it's over the top. A lot of people do say it's over the top. But, you know, I wonder if that's where, if you were designing on a computer to give a construction crew instructions to build, you know, looking at those things as a science, you would say that's too big or that's too wide or it's too much. Whereas when you're feeling it and you're going with your heart and your instincts in the field, you're able to allow yourself to build things that maybe sitting in a lab, you know, you'd never green light.
That's a good point. I think part of it is, you know, this is sculpture on a large scale. So, you know, when Michelangelo got the block of granite that he, you know, made David from, and there was this major defect, supposedly, in that, you know, that sculptors have been looking at that piece of marble. I guess it's marble. Yeah. You know, they're like, oh, we can't use that because that's never going to work. And somehow he figured out a way to do that. And it's the most amazing thing you've ever seen. So I think that's part of the, for me, that part of that's that sort of artistic side where you're reacting to what the ground's giving you and stuff. And, you know, when you stick the shovel in, the excavator, the blade of the dozer, whatever, you know, there's things that you encounter, you feel, or that you're reacting to. And there's things that you see that are inherent in the landscape that you want to not screw up, you know, that you want to leave as is. I think that's the hardest thing for, if you're working on a project and you've got shapers that are there doing stuff and, you know, maybe you haven't worked with them, so they don't really understand what you're trying to do or how you're trying to do stuff. And they're just accustomed to, oh, well, you know, we touch everything, we backblade it and we do this. And like, I'm always pointing things out and saying, you see that? And it might be just this micro contour. It's like, leave that alone. You don't need to quote, fix it. You know, humans are always trying to fix everything. And when we try and fix it, we probably screw things up. So that randomness or that thing that is Mother Nature's done, those are things that are really, really difficult to replicate or build. And, you know, you have to recognize that. And you also have to say, well, that's enough. Like, don't do any more. And like Kingsley and Gray Walls, they do have some extreme stuff on them because the terrain's kind of extreme in some cases. I mean, there's 60-foot granite walls and gray walls. It's just like you think of this landscape and you're like, how does this work? But, you know, figuring out a way to where you could traverse and get up. There's sort of a low section of the property. There's a middle section of the property, which is this high plateau in the middle, which is where 1T, 10th hole, 9th hole, 18th tee, 17th hole, 11th tee. It's kind of like all on this big triangular sort of platform. And then the southern valley goes below that. And that's just pure sand down there. It's like some of the best fescue fairways that... I mean, there was a mixture of stuff, and really it's most of the fairways are bluegrass there, but there's fescue in the mix, and the sand is so good down there that the 12th fairway is basically pure fescue, and it's just like unbelievably good to play off of. And then the north side of that, which is really one half of number one and then through eight, is all in this low section down there. And you had to figure out how to traverse between these different elevations and stuff, these different sort of segments of the property. And it works out pretty well, but there's 200 feet of elevation change on the property. So that's kind of crazy, but it works out ultimately. And Kingsley actually, there's only about 110 feet of elevation change, but some parts of it feel crazier than other parts. And people see the first hole and they go, oh, I could never walk this. But it's just because you've just seen this big heave in this, you know, super wide, 110-yard wide fairway with this massive bunker complex in the middle of this shoulder. And then you get up to the first green and, you know, it's a big par five. So it's three shots. And you kind of like gets you going. And then you stand on the second tee and you can see the entire front nine or most of the front nine, and kind of works its way around some big features. But the holes themselves, if you're not spraying it really badly, it's a really good walk. It's not flat. It's definitely not flat, but so some of that I think is a reaction to what a site gives you. And if you have like a really, really flat site, you can still build really cool features, and you can provide interest and subtlety within that. Because even a flat site has something going on. You know, there's a small drainage way or this or that. How do you build off of that? How do you use that to your advantage?
Talking about visiting Royal Melbourne and looking at that string of 3, 4, 5, 6 and how it worked around the hill, going to some courses around the world and seeing particularly Mackenzie's, but other courses, I imagine, that's, you always find that instructive and something that really guides your practice and your profession?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Alistair was brilliant at that. The Valley Club in Santa Barbara, you know, just north of Los Angeles, is a great example of that. You play the first hole, second hole, and you cross this road. And there's basically, it's sort of a tilt in the landscape, and there's this river gorge going through it, and there's two hills. There's these two knobs, and each of those knobs impact or affect 5 or 6 holes with how they get utilized. So the third green is at the base of a hill, the fourth tee is on a hill, the fifth tee drives past that hill, and the next hill, 6 doesn't really affect it. 7 comes back around both of them to the base of the other one. 8's a tee on, hitting to the other hill, par 3. Then 9 drives away from that hill. 10 comes back around it to the base of it. 11 like hits off of it. It's incredible how these two features, and basically a sort of a generally flat but tilted land, affect all these different holes. It's just absolute genius with how he does. And he does that in a lot of places where he takes a feature and he comes back or returns to it in a number of different ways that makes it really, really successful. Cypress Point does that when 6 comes down at the base, 7 tees on it, 9 comes to it, 10 goes away from it. And then 12's down at the base of it on the other side, like really down. You wouldn't think of it as the same feature because it just feels totally different. But, you know, that's a, you know, he's just really, really good at that. It's great, great stuff to study, you know, and to try and not copy that, but to recognize there's feature points. 7 miles got that with how, what we call a junction, the second green, 9th green, and the 12th green are sort of in the same area as well. You know, the third tee goes up higher, just around the corner from the second green, and then the 10th and the 13th. So you have this convergence of three holes coming and leaving. So it impacts at various times of the round. You know, the golfer three different times, you look at it, those features differently each time, works really well. And then there's another place where two opposing holes come together, even though you don't see the other green, you might see the flag depending on where the flag is, because there's like a dune between them. And then those two holes go in opposite directions. So it's 6 to 7 and 11 to 12, where, you know, you sort of come on to each other and sort of see another group or something, which is really cool. I think it's fun. Golf's a social game. And so it's, you know, it's good to have them, you know, see other people, whether you know those people or you just go, hey, oh, hey, I've never had that beer, whatever, you know, or how's the hot dog? You know, how's the hot dog here? Whatever the deal is. Or in Australia, it'd be sausage. We don't do hot dogs here. It's kind of funny that the, you know, various things that, you know, are similar, but still very different, you know.
Have you had a meat pie while you've been in Australia, Mark?
Oh yeah, many times. the bakery on King Island, I swear it is the best. I know everybody has their favorite, like, oh, these are the best pies. I swear, King Island Bakehouse is without a doubt. There's always a line. It's unbelievable. It's really good.
Yeah,
really good.
You talk a bit there about the routing on 7 Mile Beach. When I visited this time last year, the thing that struck me was that I felt like you could have built, you know, a routing there where there was 18 postcard holes with full frontal views of the bay. And it felt like to not do that must have been a really deliberate move to try to have some light and shade in the routing and disappear into the dunes and then reappear with the view. And Was that conscious, or was it just where kind of your instincts took you as you walked around the property?
Yeah, I think that's intentional, because it's really about building great golf holes, and the site's super spectacular no matter what. I mean, you've got this amazing, you know, vista from 1 tee and, you know, finishing up later and whatever, you know, and on the putting green or whatever, you know. So, and I mean, you see the water from every hole, you know, in some course or another, if you want. And in some cases, you're right on the ocean, or when you get into a dune sort of where you don't see the ocean, you know, where you're walking along, but you're near it, you hear the ocean. And it's not, we don't have massive waves here, but water's an incredible thing about how it really is an emotional and visceral response to it. So when you think about Cape Wickham, you experience the water in so many different ways there. That's the thing that's really, I think, incredible about the site there, is that it's really, really diverse in how you attack, look at, see the water, experience the water, feel the water. That's really different than, you know, because there's cliff holes, there's, you know, seaside holes with dunes, you know, and parts of the site. The 11th hole is basically in the ocean. I mean, it's just waves are, you know, laughing, you know, just lapping up at, right at your feet, you know, there, 16 tee, same kind of deal. So there's so much, you know, you don't have to try and make it dramatic. It already is. And so you got to focus on the golf. And because if the golf isn't good, people, you know, people aren't going to come back. A good friend of mine was out at Wickham fairly early on. He's a really good player. This guy's, he's played the Trans Mississippi. You know, he's a high level amateur player in his day, and you know, loves golf, avid golfer. And I didn't even know that he was going over right away. And he called me up afterwards, and he's like, dude, I knew it was going to be spectacular, but the golf is really good. You know, so, you know, I mean, that, you know, and he's not going to BS me. If there's something he didn't like, he was going to, you know, give me the hardcore thing. But, you know, that was the overall theme, was like, wow, you know, the golf was really good. I knew it was going to be spectacular. So, you know, hopefully we're achieving that at 7 Mile. I think we are. And I think there are some, you know, there's a big high ridge, then there's medium dunes, there's a deflation basin, which is really sort of the flat part of the golf course, and then there's low medium dunes at the seaside. And so you get a lot of different sort of experiences with that, and you do have the junction and these other interaction points where you crisscross or you know, get close to another group, but it's very comfortable. It's not like you're on top of each other. And I think you know, we're really focusing on what the golf is, because you're going to have plenty of views. You're going to see things. And like you were saying, Scott, there are these windows where there's like a big dune sort of bordering a hole. And then there's this gap, and if you pay attention and you're looking around a little bit here or there, you look through and there's Spectacle Island, which is off the, you know, sort of southeast of us. And it's this small island that's off of the coast, you know, not very far out in the water, but it's sort of this distinct thing. And there's a shoal there. And, you know, on a wavy day, you see this, you know, you see this spray come up. And I mean, it's not like right in front of you. You have to sort of pay attention to it. And, you know, you might not see it the first time you go, or the third time, or whatever, but, you know, sometime you're going to be like, wow, that was cool. I just noticed that, you know, that's part of the, hopefully that's part of the, you know, what's different, you know, what did I see this time? Well, that was cool. I don't remember that.
I think that's the older I get, the more the barometer of whether a course is worth seeing is exactly what you just said. What did I see that's different? And, you know, if your course can be as good as it wants to be, I feel like if it doesn't give you something where you think, never seen that before, you know, it's not a course that you're going to insist that your mates go and see.
There are certain people that say, oh, you know, there's only so many golf holes and so many styles or this or that. And I guess I mean, you're impacted by everything that you see, and you certainly do things that are maybe in the flavor of something. And certainly there's, you know, you build a Redan feature into a lot of holes or whatever, but are you blatantly calling it a Redan? Sometimes, you know, if you're into naming holes or this or that. But I guess, you know, it's like 7 Mile is such an incredible site and so unique and special that, you know, I'm hopeful that we're building something that's just unique and different, and it's that place. And it's not, oh, this reminds me of Name a Famous Hole, you know, just input a famous hole. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But I find, you know, we're trying to create great golf and provide something that, you know, is different for us. And, you know, I've seen a lot, Clyde's seen a lot, Frank's seen a lot. And if we do something and like, oh, that's cool, because that's a really cool shot, maybe it's not related to something that we're trying to relate it to. You know, it's a specific famous shot here or there or something, but, you know, if it's a cool shot, it's like, wow, well, that's neat. And the transitions of how you go from one hole to the next, I think, is something that's going to be really special here at 7 Mile. No golf carts and like continuous turf track that, you know, you just turn around and half the time you're just 20 paces away from, you know, one of the tees at least, which is, I think, super fun. And it's just, you make this transition. And to me, that's more important than a favorite hole. You know, someone asked me that the other day, like, oh, what's your favorite hole? Unfair question, you know, it's like, who's your favorite child? You know, I have a favorite son and a favorite daughter. So I have one of each. How's that? You know, how do you cheat that question?
Well, the most important question, I think, about 7 Mile Beach at this point is when will golfers be playing?
End of the year. So we're finishing the seeding on the third and fourth hole, which are the last two just in the sequence because of irrigation, et cetera. That's getting done. So it depends on how fast that goes for the full 18. But, you know, potentially we could have a shorter loop prior to a full opening. But it's sometime, you know, towards the end of the year is what we're assuming. That we have, you know, a clubhouse. There's no clubhouse been built. Even if we don't have a clubhouse on day one, that's no big deal really. That a lot of times you have something that's temporary or it's being built. So those types of infrastructure things. I mean, this is, you know, we're 10 minutes from the airport and 25 minutes from downtown Hobart, but this is totally undeveloped land. I mean, this is like, there's no power out there yet. We're still trying to get the power poles out there. You know, we're running on generators. So that's one of the hassles, I guess, you know. Not everything's perfect, but, you know, every morning you pinch yourself and go, you know, the sunrise today was just like phenomenal. It's just incredible, you know. So,
and you see that you're getting to work early, as we found out in preparing for this.
Oh, yeah.
We weren't going to be doing this at 7:45 after Scott and I had breakfast. You'd already been at work then. So
Monday I had, or was it Tuesday? I don't know. I'm losing track. Yeah, I had three calls in the morning. So I started at 5. There was one at 5, one at 6, one at 8. And it was like, I'm just jamming them all in the same take. I'm getting up and doing these, you know, all at once and stuff. And so we're hard trying to get these things done. And I'm trying to, you know, finish prep this or that and make sure everything's right. So that's when you said, yeah, we can do it before you go to work. Well, then, you know, you guys would have to be getting up really early. So, and I figured, well, this is better. How about the evening tomorrow instead of early morning?
When things wind up, Mike, how much do you anticipate a sense of relief and satisfaction with this job reaching a conclusion? And how much sadness is there that it actually has come to an end?
Well, you know, there are always... Yeah, it's a good question. It's always exciting. You know, you're in the fervor of it and you sort of lose track. And then when you get into the end, you're kind of like, oh, we got to finish. You can't, like, you know, it's like if you're running a race, you know, you can't slack off because that guy's going to beat you, the last 15 meters or something. So you you got to, like, stay the course and, you know, you got to complete things and do it properly. Yeah, certainly there's a sense of accomplishment, but there's a lot to go. That's still got to happen, you know, the growing and things like that. So Tui and the crew, and, you know, they're going to be real busy, you know, just trying to get turf in shape and, you know, all those types of things. So there's a lot of other stuff that has to still happen. But certainly, yeah, no, it's good. And then when you get to play and everything too, that, you know, it's always fun to come back. And then, you know, I'm sure Clayton and I were first out there, everything with Matt, and, you know, we'll be like, okay, I got to try this. I've been waiting to do this for 2 years. I want to see if it's going to work as good as I thought. That's awesome. You know, that's always fun. You know, we'll be dropping balls and putting them down. That's super fun and exciting too, you know, doing that. Honestly, we really love Tassie, and I'm not necessarily excited about going to Florida if I'm old, and, you know, want a break from the Michigan winter. I'd rather come to Tassie and have your summer, the long days, and, you know, play golf at 7 Mile and Cape Wickham, and enjoy good seafood down here and all that.
This is maybe an unfair question to ask you, because it kind of is, I guess, a question about two of your children. There's some discussion and worry, I guess, that the more great golf, genuinely great golf, that the main island of Tasmania gets, I guess the more dubious the business case becomes for Cape Wickham and Ocean Dunes as well, I suppose. Is there someone who knows, I guess, the business of golf and who understands the logistics of those places? Is there a worry that as good as Cape Wickham is and as good as the land is and as thrilling as the experience is that everyone goes there, you know, there are some of those business factors and those logistics and, you know, the objective things might count against it if there's too much other good golf that's more accessible?
Well, I think for Australians, if we just look at the domestic market here, you know, there's a lot of avid golfers. I mean, you're a sporting culture. People like to play golf. They travel and they visit and they go do things. which is, you know, that's a credit to the Australian people because they travel a lot more. Like I said before, America's like, oh, it's too far. I can never do that. I'm like, it's one day and just like, go, oh, it's worth it. But I think, I think what you're seeing is that, you know, with Barn Boogle, the two courses there, plus Boogle Run, and with Wickham and with 7 Mile coming online. I mean, you know, currently you have three of the top five courses, you know, according to, you know, all the various rankings, three of the top five courses are in Tasmania, and they're all public golf. They're not private courses. It seems hard to fathom that's, you know, that one of those is going to drop out because of logistics or whatever. And really getting to King Island from Melbourne's 40-minute flight on Rex or Sharp from Tullamarine and Essendon or King Island Air from Moorabbin. So if you're, you know, if you come over from out of the country and, you know, you're here to do the, you know, my big Australian golf tour, and you're going to play Royal Melbourne and, you know, Victoria, Kingston Heath, et cetera, and you're right there in that environment. Like, why wouldn't you get on a plane and go 40 minutes to King Island and play another great experience, you know, and pack that all in. And then from there, go to, you know, Barn Boogle and 7 Mile in this case too. You know, that's going to be, you know, I think they're worth it. I mean, I think the logistics of getting to King Island is not necessarily as simple as the constant number of flights that are coming to a bigger market, whether that's Hobart, Melbourne, you know, Sydney, Adelaide, you know, all the state capitals. But it really isn't that difficult either. So, you know, you fly into Launceston and, you know, if you're taking commercial, you're not on the charter flight into Barn Boogle. And then you got to drive, what, an hour and 15, hour and 20 or something, you know, up there, which isn't like, it's not horrible, but it's not next door like at 7 Mile. I mean, that is really the unbelievable thing about that, that there's this oceanfront site that's literally right next to an international airport.
It somehow feels like it's 500 miles away from anything. You know, that drive down that sand road to get there, you know, even once that's formed up a bit more, it definitely is a location that feels like you're away. I mean, it's kind of like the way that everyone get the bingo cards out. It's kind of like the way that New South Wales Golf Club's 20 minutes from the middle of a global city, but feels nothing like that. I think 7 Mile is kind of a similar concept for Hobart.
Yeah. I would agree that, I mean, that's a good analogy to, like, because New South Wales is really, you know, you're sort of like in suburbia and then all of a sudden, where are we going? Yeah. This is even a bit more remote because it's sort of beyond all that, you know, around the airport's not really built up. You do go through some fairly dense areas before you get to New South Wales. You don't really have that sense Hobart's a much smaller city than Sydney, of course. That's, I sort of view Hobart though as kind of a mini Sydney because of the waterways and everybody has a view of the water, it's close to the water, on the water. There's a lot of, you know, it's just a really small version of Sydney in that way.
Yeah. Speaking of the surrounds of 7 Mile Beach, have you had time to duck out and play either Royal Hobart or Tasmania?
Yeah, not really. I didn't even bring my clubs this trip. Just too much to do. And we're sort of at the end, so I didn't want to have a bunch of other stuff that I got to take back. So, yeah, no, but I have. In fact, early on in the project, Anthony Tugood, the superintendent, he was up at Barn Boogle, and his family was up there, and because of the school year and stuff, he grew up here in Hobart, and basically like two doors from the first tee at Royal Hobart. His dad was a phenomenal, you know, legendary player. And he was down here, and then, you know, going back and forth on the weekends and stuff up to, you know, with the family. And but a lot of times, you know, he wouldn't do that every weekend. So be like, you know, Sunday afternoon when things would sort of chill down, and we, you know, we would go out and play and then have a cookout at his mom's house, you know, type stuff, which was good. So but yeah, but haven't done that in the last, you know, 2 months since I've been here recently. So
I'd love to know the Aussie course you'd never heard of before you started working down here that you're now a massive fan of.
Oh, it's gotta be Port Fairy.
Yes.
And that's because, you know, Clates has worked there for years, and then he sort of brought me into the fold, and, you know, when we started looking at certain things to do there, because I hadn't been there. It's far enough out of the way, you know, 15, 18 years ago, whatever it was when I first came, and you know, focused most of our time around the Sand Belt and, you know, up in Sydney a little bit. And so that and Barnboogle. So, you know, that was, yeah, seeing that, it's really cool. It's just it's a phenomenal golf course. I'm hoping that we can get some of these sort of things squared away, and it just tweaks that would make it even just that much better. Such a fun, you know, nice membership there too. They're very welcoming, and it's very reasonable too. I mean, it's not super expensive or anything. It's just
$50.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. You mentioned Barnboogle before. You're heading up for a day out of Hobart. You got time for 18 holes only, or 20, 18 to 20 holes. Which course are you choosing to play if you've only got one round?
I'm going to play the original Dunes. Just a little bit. I don't know. There's just some stuff there that, I mean, they're both fantastic. But it just has a couple things there that I really like, and some of the green approaches better. You know, there's a couple things I don't like here, but I mean, that's, you know, that's just nitpicky. That doesn't, I think they're both really, really strong. And maybe that's just the tendency of, you know, the greens are a little bit wilder in some cases, and it kind of just feels like the property a bit more. And that's also a credit to Lost Dunes, which is more subdued in certain areas. And then when you get into some of the wilder terrain, you do have some bigger, crazier stuff, which is cool, which is a really nice sort of transition, I think, and sort of a comfort level that works really well. We were, Clates and I were up there maybe like a year ago or something. And I remember the pin was in the back on five and Lost Farm. Clates is like, I never see it there. This is great. He's, you know, he's like, oh, this is a great shot. I love this, you know. And I think I was, you know, I had pulled my drive a little. I was trying to rope like a hybrid up there or something. That was like, I was way back. You know, didn't really have a chance, but it was fun. We just messed around with that, you know, just like hitting putts there for a while, you know, because it was cool to have it there. So they're both really, I mean, they're both really excellent. But I think the edge would go to the Dunes, I guess.
Where have you not been in the world that you'd love to go?
A few places. I've never been to Seminole. Haven't been to Macrahanish. Just didn't make the, you know, the trek down there. Haven't been to Moorefontaine. Would really like to see that someday. And then Banff and Jasper, two Stanley Thompson courses in the Rocky Mountains of the Canadian Rockies. Don't know that I'm ever going to get there because, you know, the time to go is the height of the summer. And if I'm home, I'm kind of just sort of want to be home. I don't want to make another trip, which is sad. I mean, I think they've got to just be really, really cool because Stanley's work is phenomenal. And I have seen Cape Breton Highlands, Highland Lynx, out in Nova Scotia, the tip of Nova Scotia. What was that? 5-6 years ago. We were out in Maine. My daughter lived out in Portland, Maine, and we went out for a deal, and then our 30th anniversary was like right after that. And Annie and I drove into the Maritimes and did a bunch of stuff there because we'd never been out there, and it's a really amazing country. And I'm like, we got to go, you know, Cape Breton Highlands Lakes. I got to go with this. We've got to do this. And it was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. We stayed in the lodge there. And I'm like, I like lobster, but I'm not a huge lobster fan. But you're like, you know, you're sitting in the dining room there, and you're looking at the trawlers like out on either side, because it's on this little spit that goes out. It's just old 1930s, you know, lodge. So it's just, there's this, like, you don't have to have a coat and tie in there, but you feel like you want to put one on. It just has this old school sort of feel. The chef is amazing, really good. It was the best lobster I've ever had in my life. I mean, they probably just went to the trawler, pulled a pot, you know, threw it in, and you know, it was probably that fresh. I mean, it was, but it's a really, really cool golf course. Very underrated, I think. It's a golf adventure, really. I mean, so I've seen that, and you know, maybe you know, someday be nice if I get to Jasper and Banff. Those would be cool to see.
You know what I like about you, Mike DeVries? I actually just asked you where haven't you traveled that you'd love to see, but you immediately just listed golf courses. And that's how we know that you are as much of a degenerate as anyone who listens to this pod.
Yep. Yeah, I'm a golf tragic, that's for sure.
Well, thank you very much for your time. You've been incredibly generous. We appreciate it.
Super fun. Yeah, great to chat with you guys. So we'll look forward to seeing you down here at 7 Mile when it gets open.
Oh, so, don't tempt me.
And we're swinging the sticks. That'll be good.